Ray Lynch's hypnotic clouds below your knees signals that it is 8 p.m. on Wednesday and time for So What's Your Story, the only program originating in Houston devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM Houston. Along with our team, co-hosts Mary Edgerton, Warren Holloman, Hank Rubicek, engineer Nicole Rocherlin, and, of course, last but not least, Floyd the Wonder Dog, I am Greg Audell, your co-host of this gem of a program, and I am thrilled to be with you for the next hour. Every week, we share the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on journeys from the familiar to the foreign, and we get to experience these journeys through the eyes of the storyteller. So sit back and relax, just as we do every Wednesday. And I got to tell you, friends, I've been looking forward to tonight's show for a long time because our guests represent one of the top children's literacy programs in the nation, and we are so fortunate that it is based right here in Houston, Texas. Since 1983, Writers in the Schools, or WITS as it is known, has worked with educators and professional writers to teach students how to write well. For over 30 years, WITS has changed the minds of thousands of young Houstonians about writing. Writers in the Schools also recognize that creativity and language skills work as the essential formula in helping over 38,000 children learn the power of written expression each and every year. If you hear passion in my voice about WITS, it's because I have been a proud board member for the last 5 years. Robin Riegler has been our amazing, amazing executive director for WITS for over 20 years, and she has been with WITS for over 25 years, I believe. That is, we are a lucky bunch, and the kids of Houston are well served because of it. Maggie Monahan has been a WITS writer in residence for nine years, but has been on staff for the last 2 years. Isn't that correct? Wow. You started when you were five, I guess? Each will convey a few stories about the impact the program has made on our county's children. And so welcome to your story, both Robin and Maggie. We are thrilled to have you here.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
You know, and before we, you know, get into the stories, I want to ask both of you, because it is now the question I think we all greet each other with, and we almost sheepishly ask, how were you in the storm? How did it affect each of you?
We're okay. My family, fondly known of as Girlville, made it through the storm successfully and with a few power outages along the way, but we are safe and sound. And WITS also did well. We're right here in this neighborhood near KPFT, and we were lucky also. So
thank goodness.
Very lucky all around.
And our hearts go out to our friend Tina, Angelo, and a couple of our board members who are not so lucky. And, you know, I hope those of you with WITS who were affected will pick up the phone, send out an email, and let us know when we can help you. Because, friends, that is what we all need to be doing for each other right now. Well, how about you, Maggie?
I also, this was my first hurricane. So
welcome to Houston.
Welcome. I feel very welcome. And yes, I was... No water in my apartment, and just a heavy heart with those who did not experience the same. So thankful and also happy to have sleeves rolled up and doing.
You know, I haven't talked to anyone about this. I don't know if this is a common feeling, but I find myself being a bit embarrassed that I was unscathed because so many people I care about lost their homes, lost their cars. Mm-hmm. you know, didn't have enough food for the week. They didn't realize everything was going to be closed and you couldn't get out. So, you know, I feel a certain sheepishness, you know, friends call from all over the country. How are you? I'm like, I'm fine, you know, but I think we've still all been through the trauma. And we certainly owe it to those who have been affected to do everything we can to help them, just like y'all have been doing at the various shelters.
Absolutely.
And before we get into the shelter work, I'm just curious, because I don't know the whole story, Robin, of how did Writers in the Schools get started?
Well, we have been around for 34 years now, and we began, really, the program was started by Marv Hoffman and Philip Lopate, who both had been involved in a similar program in New York City called Teachers and Writers Collaborative. And they both ended up in Houston because of the U of H Creative Writing Program. Marv is married to Rosellen Brown, who was a professor in the program, and Philip Lopate was also a professor in the program. And they ended up in Houston at the same time. They looked around them and they said, you know, Houston would really benefit from a program like Teachers and Writers Collaborative in New York City. And basically, they put it together. They banded together five graduate students. Marv had connections to HISD and was able to find placements for those writers. And that's how Writers in the Schools began.
Well, let me say about Marv Hoffman and Rosellen Brown. I was lucky to go to their go to high school with their daughter Adina and spent many wonderful hours in their home. And you know, they're just wonderful people. And when I joined Writers in the Schools, I was so thrilled to find out that he had started it, because I didn't know anything about it. Strangely enough, my niece's grandfather later hired Adina to work for the Jerusalem Post. So it's a very small world.
Wow.
And how did you end up getting connected with WITS, Robin?
Well, I was in the English department one day, and I was poking around. It was my first year in the PhD program, and I found a door that didn't have a professor's name on it. And I thought that was funny, and I opened it, you know, sort of Alice in Wonderland, and I looked in, and I was like, who are you guys? And they said, we're WITS.
Oh, I love it. I never heard this before.
And they told me what WITS did, and I had been a high school teacher when I lived in New York City, and I said to them, wait, I could teach creative writing, but skip faculty meetings, skip grading, skip standardized testing, and just do the things that I love the most. And they said, yep.
And 26 years later, they still haven't let you out of the room, huh?
I says, sign me up for that. And I've loved it.
Well, we are certainly well served. I mean, I've worked with a lot of executive directors in a lot of programs. I don't know anyone that has more respect from the staff, from the board, and from those you serve as you. And that's something you've really worked hard to earn over the years. And I mean it.
Thank you. What
about you, Maggie? What attracted you to Writers in the Schools?
Robin. No. I moved to Houston in, I guess, 2009 to do my MFA at University of Houston. And I was broke. and I was looking for a way to make extra money that also wouldn't kill my soul. And that's...
Oh, I like that. I think a lot of people are on that mission.
And sometimes the soul goes first, but I was determined for that not to happen. And so I had learned about WITS through our department, our creative writing department, and immediately was just taken incredibly by the mission of the organization and the people especially. And I've been through several jobs since in various capacities, doing editing and teaching and being a ghostwriter and several other things. But I was so happy to land at WITS full-time about 2 years ago, 2 years ago this month.
Again, so. I am amazed by the quality of people that come through our doors, and you're a testament to that. You know, so many organizations have stepped up to help Harvey victims in unique ways that we wouldn't even think of. How has WITS and its push for literacy helped victims of Harvey?
We have been sending writers into the shelters pretty much from the moment we were able to leave our homes, which, as we know here in Houston, but the rest of the world may not know, took 5 days. The rains kept going on and on. It felt very Noah's Ark for a while there. But at the point when we were able to leave our homes, writers very quickly volunteered to go in and work with children. It's a program very similar to what we did in Katrina, because many people from New Orleans were displaced and sent to Houston, and we worked with children at that point. And the way it works is we're basically doing storytelling, we're playing with kids, we're tapping their imaginations, and giving them a chance to tell their story.
Wow. It's funny, again, you know, I've seen different music groups, and I don't think people realize how much you need when you're in a shelter with kids 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, you know, and you let them escape for just a mm-hmm. little bit through their imaginations.
Yeah, we were thankful for our partnership with the YMCA and with other partners here in the community to be able to participate in this kids zone that was housed in the George R. Brown Convention Center and is being replicated over at NRG. And really, in working with children, it would be interesting and unsurprising also to see where you would ask parents, hey, would you like for us to spend some time with your kiddos for a little while? And they would say, oh, please, like, please just take them for 2 hours so I can sit here and hear myself think. And I think that's a pretty universal experience wherever you go. If you have big-hearted people who want to give kids an opportunity to be kids, parents, go ahead.
Well,
you can have
again,
them.
It's just a reminder that there are so many needs that we're not even, you know, that don't come to the forefront of the mind. We've been thinking about mm-hmm. food, water, shelter, mm-hmm. but we need more than food, water, and shelter to live, don't we?
That's right.
So many people have narratives of this incredible tragedy, Hurricane Harvey. But as Art Linklater used to say, kids say the darndest things, don't they, Maggie?
They do. They do. Well, I mean, when I was a kid, our sticky Pennsylvania summers were filled with lots of make-believe games. And so my siblings and I, we would string stage curtains out of old Sesame Street bed sheets, and we wrote new and improved scripts for our favorite Disney movies. We would choreograph music videos for Michael Jackson's Dangerous album, which was our favorite album. And we would just spend hours and hours in the basement playing what we called Dark Ages, which is when we turned off all the lights and we would masquerade around in our mom's old yellow and fuchsia prom dresses, which were really special. And we would be speaking in our best English accents. And probably most of all, we loved building time machines. And so usually this would mean emptying the contents of our bedroom closets, much to our parents' dismay, and then climbing inside and taping the walls with our drawings of colorful buttons and dials and switches. And we thought that these closet time machines were the absolute best thing until one summer our parents got a new refrigerator. And in the weeks to follow, that huge empty box in the garage became pure and total magic. And it was our special hideout, a dark and cooler refuge from parents and chores. It was a shelter from mosquitoes. It was a ticket to a bigger world. And it was as if we could just figure out the right combination of buttons and dials and switches, who knew what amazing things would await us when we stepped out of the time machine and back into the light of day. And I haven't thought about that refrigerator box in a really long time. But last week over at the convention center, I recognized it. I saw it from across the room as my new buddies, Davian and Abu, led me by the hand to their very special fort. And so we snaked our way through a sea of cots and blankets and belongings. And there was this beautiful empty box right there in the middle of the room. And it was a space that could be anything at all, anything that they wanted it to be. And so Davian said, come on in. And he lifted up the cardboard flap that had somehow been cut out of this box. And so I got down on my hands and my knees, and I poked my head into the darkness, and Abu was sitting in there, and he smiled back at me from the inside corner, and he was like, isn't this awesome? And there, you know, smack dab in the middle of the noise and the need and the exhaustion and the loss, these boys had chosen to stand on the shorelines of their imaginations and create a new and a hopeful world. And as I said, I came to Houston to study creative writing, but I stayed in Houston because of Writers in the Schools. And it's an organization that I feel truly believes in the life-giving and even the life-saving power of the imagination. We believe that every child has a voice, that every voice is valuable and deserves to be heard, and that the act of sharing our stories is what, in fact, makes us human and what connects us to each other. And whenever I'm talking about WITS, I like to say something like, you know, wherever kids are, that's where we want to be. And that includes inside a cardboard box in the middle of the fourth largest city in the nation. And in the aftermath of Harvey, I've had the opportunity to sit with some of our city's children at the GRB and the NRG and listen to their voices. And it has reminded me and affirmed in me two things. One, that kids are kids wherever they go. And two, that playfulness and imagination and creativity are trustworthy tools for healing, even in a Category 4 hurricane. Even in a hurricane, kids want to sit in your lap and wear your sunglasses. You know, they want to pretend to be tigers and practice their really cool superhero moves with you. They want to cover you in stickers. They want to braid your hair and use crayons as like the rollers in your hair. But most of all, when they believe that you are truly listening, kids want to talk. They're natural storytellers, and they want to tell you about their pets, of course. They want to tell you about their best friends, about their dream vacations, about what they want to be when they grow up. And at WITS, I feel our most important job is to listen, to really listen, and to celebrate and encourage and elevate the words of these kids at every level. I learned to love writing because my grandmother and my mother had my siblings and I keep journals, and they would ask us simple questions like, what did you see today? And what did you eat for lunch? And my brother, you know, my sister and I would say, well, today our little brother Billy took off all his clothes and yelled nudie, nudie, nudie and ran through the backyard. Or today I lost my lollipop necklace and I think it's at Renee's house and I can't find it. And while nothing that I wrote as a young child was terribly profound, it was all, in fact, terribly important because it taught me to see the value in my own experiences and my beliefs and my interactions with the world, and then in turn to see and value the experiences and beliefs of others. And that's what I love about where I get to work, not where I have to work, where I get to work, is that we as a community of writers are committed to excavating and elevating the stories of our young people. And emboldening them to use their words to create a more just and beautiful world. Because, you know, one day these kiddos, the Davians and the Abus and the Tianas and the Bobbies and Anthonys and Nathans and Zayas and all of these children are going to tell their stories to their children about what happened when it rained for days and days and they needed to leave their homes and to live in a new and unfamiliar place. And it's really my hope that peppered within their stories and their family's stories, that there might be little treasured moments, however small, of play and lightness and getting to be a kid even when tragedy strikes. There's an Irish saying I love, that it is in the shelter of each other that the people live. And I would expand upon that by saying it is in the stories of each other that the people live. And when we take the time to sit and listen to the story of another person, especially a child, they may not know where even to start the story, but the act of listening is powerful and it invites generosity and willingness within the speaker. And when kids know that they are busy being listened to every time, they can't help but fill empty spaces, air and pages and cardboard boxes with all kinds of magic. And their giggles bounce across poured concrete floors, and their litanies of favorite foods transform simple phrases like shrimp with garlic butter into prayerful syllables in a crowded convention hall. And their red ninja lava superpowers are somehow enough to defeat the blue ninja's endless waves and water. And that's what I know.
Oh, Maggie, I love this story. I got goosebumps when you were talking about the kids and just sort of picturing them in what most of us would consider horrific conditions. I mean, who wants to live in the George R. Brown or NRG Center? But I love the sparkle that I could see in the kids' eyes just through your story.
Thank you. Yeah, the sparkle is real.
What was it like when you first entered the first time, you know, the shelter, were you concerned about how you would be met or the reaction you would get?
It was, I would say, overwhelming. And also there's a feeling of entering someone's home and you don't want to make a wrong move. You want to be incredibly respectful. And so...
What a good point. Yeah. What a good point. It is their home.
Yeah. And so there
was their family.
Exactly. So there was a sense of treading carefully, warmly, but carefully, and looking to be led and allowing those who have been placed in positions of leadership there, those wise and really well-organized, big-hearted leaders, letting them lead you, I think was really important to our experience of being good guests within this home.
Well, I got to say, thank you on behalf of the kids. I mean, you know, I suspect you let them escape that shelter in their minds when they were in that box. You know, they were no longer in the shelter. They were in wherever their imaginations created.
Yeah, we hope so. We hope so. Even if it's just for a moment, I think those little moments matter very much.
And I think that something that happens in all with settings is that the children lead.
Mm.
Children have a different way of telling a story from adults. And I think Meggie got at that in her story. But it's like we as adults, we have this sense of sequence, kind of a sense that, you know, you start with the beginning and you tell what happened in order, and you're very interested in cause and effect, and all of those things are part of the story. A child may not even have a sense of any of that.
Mm-hmm.
It might be that, you know, it's not going to be a beginning or a middle or an end at all. The child may have no sense of when it began. Mm-hmm. And
right,
of course,
right,
for these children in a shelter, it's not over.
Right.
It's still happening. But one of the stories that I heard in the George R. Brown was a child telling a story about a monkey. And she was a monkey in the story, of course. And the monkeys had this thing happen. An elephant came up one day, and with her trunk, she inhaled the entire lake. And shot the water up into the air, and it rained for days and days. And
wow,
the monkey screamed and screamed and dropped her banana. And that was the end of the story. This is actually, some of the stories we heard were much shorter, mm-hmm, some much longer. Mm-hmm. But this was the kind of thing for this child. We didn't say, tell us what happened. We said, tell us a story. And
wow,
this is the story we heard. No matter what the story is, it's going to contain the sort of secret that is inherent in what has just happened. And
that's a good point.
It's a bit like a dream, right? Or at least for us as adults, it would be like something you might dream. She's telling the story of what happened, actually. But in this imagery, in this dream imagery that for her is safe, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's not dangerous in some way, but it still is. It contains the kernel of what happened. It rained and rained. She screamed. She dropped her banana. And that's the kind of thing that I think we are charged with. We hear that story. We listen to that story. We kind of love that story. And we empathize with that monkey.
Mm-hmm.
And that is our job as writers, I think, is we don't say, oh, that represents Hurricane Harvey that just happened, right?
Yeah.
That's not what it's about.
Right.
It's about connecting on the level of story, storyteller to storyteller, sort of, I really feel for that monkey in that story and what happened to her.
Well, I'm just so appreciative that in the midst of everything going on at the shelter, that these kids have someone who's asking them their stories and they have the opportunity to tell them. Because, again, I don't think that's probably number one, two, or three on anyone's priority list the first few days, you know, of trying to get people shelter, and how that must feel to a child to have someone say, hey, I want to hear your story.
Well, every morning, I did the kickoff every morning at George R. Brown, and Maggie took over after me. But every morning, the pediatricians came by to brief us and tell us sort of things to look for in the children and where the clinic was and, you know, who what to do if you saw some child doing certain things, scratching. They told us what the issues were in the shelter. And one of the things they said to us is that really the majority of health problems are in children in a shelter situation because they are so small. Mm-hmm. And people don't think to look at them,
right,
and to pay attention to them. And of course, if you've lost your home, you've lost your job. I mean, you've lost everything.
Right.
Right. There are a lot of things to think about for these parents, too. But I thought about that a lot. And just the fact that because they're small, they may not get the kind of attention that they would normally get. And I think that's what we were providing, that kind of attention, a quality of attention, a kind of real listening and writing down what they had to say. And then here's a copy back. You know, would you like this? It was,
oh, so they got to keep a copy of their stories?
If they wanted, yes.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes.
You know, I relate to so much of what you say because in another lifetime, years ago, I worked with homeless shelters for abused women and children. And that was the one thing I always saw in the shelters is that the family were in such crisis and the shelter was doing everything they could, that the best you could do for the kids was, here's a snack, here's a TV, we got grown-up stuff to deal with. And I think Houston is much more attuned this time, that children have real needs and they are every bit as much victims as the adults who are worrying about their mortgage, their truck, their house, their future. Kids have their own, you know, what kids need are stability and consistency. And that's one thing they've lost in this. Mm-hmm. I think you bring a bit of normalcy to them when you ask them to tell their stories.
And connection. I think that when we think about basic needs, it's easy. I just remember the very idea of going to school for fine arts. It was like there was this whole thing in me that was like, this is so frivolous. Like, this is so just self-indulgent to, like, you're going to go spend all this money and all this time studying poetry. And then it was like, no, there's some kind of soul need being met when you're willing to sit with your own story, to study stories, to study words and language and to hear them in the air. And I think that a basic need that we're out to meet as best we can and to co-meet with each other and with these kiddos is connection.
Yes.
And
that's what storytelling does.
Yeah. And the adult stuff that you mentioned, like, you know, standing in the FEMA line, you know, getting the supplies that you need, all of these things are obviously like top of the list. And that child who has so many things to say and no one to listen is also on the list. And so however we can fold into that, we're grateful to do it.
I once went to an exhibit at Project Row Houses that I've always remembered. And all the art in the exhibit was by children who were had experienced sexual abuse or some kind of abuse. And they had been given T-shirts, and one room was full of T-shirts. And I looked at these shirts, and, you know, they had used the T-shirt paint, and they had decorated their shirts. I would say 90, maybe even 95% of these kids had written their story.
Wow.
There might have been some, you know, small drawings on them, but for the most part, that given a platform, given a shirt that they knew was going to be seen and read and shared, what they wanted was to tell the story. And I've always remembered that the opportunity to tell the story is a need. It's a very basic human need, and it is what kicks off the healing process.
Absolutely. That's exactly what I was thinking while you were saying it. It's an essential part of this, of the healing process. I am your host, Greg Audell.
Do you want me to
And you are listening to my guest storytellers from Writers in the Schools, Executive Director and gifted writer and poet, Robin Riegler, and Whits Houston writer in residence, Maggie Monahan, on So What's Your Story? Only on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 91.9 for our friends in Huntsville. And we want to thank KPFT board member extraordinaire Bob Gartner for filling in last week for Nicole. But I am happy to have Nicole Rocherlin back at the control board. Nicole, I haven't even had a chance to ask you, how did you fare in the storm?
I'm grateful that my son and I were stuck in Stafford on accident. We got detoured. Well, I won't say it was by accident. I think it was by the spirit that led us that way. But we were stranded away from our home for 6 days. But gratefully, we were fine.
How about your animals?
Actually, my puppy now lives in Corpus Christi with my parents. They stole her because they fell in love with her.
And I hope your parents were well, too. But I want to know, how did your dogs in Corpus Christi do?
Actually, my parents, my dad wound up going to McAllen. My mom works for the transportation there, so she got stuck in Corpus. So the dog was in McAllen and laid up in a hotel room with my dad.
Your dogs travel more than I do, Nicole.
They travel. She has traveled more than I
have. And I know you.
I bet
they travel first class.
You're right.
Nicole, thanks to our guest storytellers, the tireless work of our entire team, and our growing presence across the internet, which you are very responsible for, our audience continues to grow each and every week. Nicole, what makes this city tune in to hear the incredible stories that our storytellers share, do you think?
Well, because we have four incredible hosts and me as your engineer.
Oh,
so
thank you.
That would definitely be the reason for that. But no, we're very diverse and multifaceted in our storytelling here, and we can definitely reach a broad range of individuals, and they can relate to it.
Very well said. You know, I think people are surprised when I tell them that Houston is the country's mecca for both writing and storytelling. How about telling our listeners about some of the storytelling events that they can make them avail themselves to?
Well, to start, everyone needs to follow us on our Facebook page. And
absolutely.
Please, yes. And while you're there, you want to share it with your friends, your family, your coworkers, the people you don't like. And also tell them why they're there. Like us on the way out.
Yes, we need you to like us, to really, really like us,
yes,
in the words
like
of Sally
us,
Field.
Like us. But we also have some program clips on YouTube and all of our past So What's Your Story programs on the Houston Storytellers website at www.houstonstorytellers.org. And all you have to do is just go to the radio program and enjoy. And speaking of the Guild is our proud sponsor, and they have their swaps that meet on the fourth Tuesday of every month at Temple Emmanuel at 1500 Sunset. Also, don't miss out on our friends at the Moth Warehouse Live on the second Tuesday of every month. And by the way, guys, we are on Twitter. We are on Instagram. And make sure you follow us there, too.
Absolutely. There's a wide variety of ways to follow us and listen to our old stories. And you know, if you're listening here, I think you're going to enjoy getting a little bit more of what we're able to give you each and every week. And friends, I am heartbroken to announce that the Moth has canceled this Friday night's Moth Grand Slam that was to be held at the University of Houston's Cullen Auditorium. A new date will be announced soon, and those who purchase tickets will be reimbursed or the tickets will be honored for another night. I am told they're going to reschedule the date, but none has been announced as of yet. I am very sorry that we won't be able to perform for a city that could use some laughter and some fun evening out. But I assure you that Dr. Hank and myself, who are scheduled to perform, along with eight other wonderful storytellers who have won the monthly story slams, that we will perform whenever and wherever we are invited to. And though we won't make this Friday, we look forward to a make-up date very soon. And last year's Grand Slam was a blast. Everyone there had a good time. Not only did we sell out, but I think they had to turn away about 300 people. So as soon as we have the make-up date, I hope you'll get your tickets as soon as you possibly can. This is Greg Audell, and you are listening to So What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1. And my guests are Robin Riegler and Maggie Monahan from Writers in the Schools. And friends, tonight it is time for the Tips for the Teller, a tip that will help you develop your storytelling skills and a whole lot more. The late George Burns, who was a favorite of mine, would tell young performers, The secret to acting is sincerity. And if you can fake that, you've got it made. George knew this would apply to storytelling as well. Because you need to understand that you're going to have a different experience every single time you face an audience. It's going to be a different audience. Some days you'll feel that what you're saying with every fiber of your being. Other times you might not be feeling it quite so much. But you must still be able to pull up those emotions that connect you and your audience to the topic. Sometimes you'll genuinely feel the emotions. Other times you'll have to recall those feelings. But either way, your audience must feel that you are emotionally tied to what you're saying, because if you are bored by what you're saying, I assure you, your audience will be bored too. But if you're confident and passionate about what you're saying, your audience will be too. Be bold, be heard, and most importantly, have fun. Now, Robin, you've spoken before thousands of audiences. When did you build up your confidence that you needed to, hold an audience in the grasp of your hands? Because I've seen you speak and I don't see any nerves.
I was going to say, I don't think I've gotten to that point yet. I'm working on it, but...
You always appear perfectly confident when I see you speak.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I think that part of it for me is a sort of idea of who I'm speaking to. I think, Maggie and I are both graduates of the creative writing program at U of H. And as a writer, you think a lot about audience. And I think that when I'm speaking to people, whether it's quite perfect or on the mark or not, I'm not sure. But I have this idea that I am talking to babysitters of toddlers, or I am talking to people who sell brooms.
So you're saying be cognizant of your audience.
Exactly.
What about you, Maggie? When did you start to feel the confidence you have as a speaker?
Oh, goodness. I don't know.
Or do you just fake it really well?
I'm pretty good at faking it. I was thinking in listening to what Robin was just saying about a teacher I had in high school who said that every time he gets up to teach, he pictures that the entire room is made up of 28, and then he named his best friend. So 28 Dans.
I think that
helps, is just imagining and believing that you're speaking with love to every person in the room. That helps me.
Well, I'll tell you one thing I do to cheat, especially if it's a very large crowd. I intentionally have my friends sit in different parts of the auditorium so I know exactly where they are. I can't see them from the stage, but when I look at this corner, I know Mike's there. When I look at this corner, I know Brian's there. And it just makes it easy for me that I'm just talking to my buddies.
Mm-hmm. I like that. I'm going to use that.
I once went to a reading of Jim Shepherd. He's a novelist and short story writer. And my partner, Marcia, and I were sitting together in the audience. And he told us afterwards that basically the two of us made every audience perfect, because she has this sort of meaningful eye contact sort of continuously the entire reading. And I have this very loud laugh, and I laugh at all the right parts of the story.
You are a good friend.
Yes.
Now you have to go to all my speaking engagements.
The two of us together.
All right.
Yeah, are the audience.
And I'll make sure you know where the laugh lines are.
You don't have to. I know.
Maggie, I'd love to hear more about, your thoughts on the last week and the kids that, you've worked with.
I have so enjoyed getting to play, getting to color. I know that adult coloring is a big thing, and I've enjoyed getting to just spend time with the kiddos. And usually we've been entering through art and just saying, hey, you want to color with me? And they're, yeah, I want to color with you. And we sit down on the floor and we start pulling all the coloring books and stickers. Stickers are a huge hit. And pulling all these things out of my backpack. And from there, just starting to just talk. It's been fun to just get to play. And yesterday at the NRG, I was realizing that I was feeling a little tired. And so just getting to color alongside of the kids, I found myself being like, oh, this is why they say adult coloring is so soothing. But one thing that has been coming up for me is that in working with the kids in more of this writer in residence role, you know, my job right now with WITS is doing program management. So I've been working a lot behind the scenes and working on communicating with our partners, and my work, I guess, my identity as a writer, not that it's taking a back seat. In fact, Robin is very good about reminding all the writers at Writers in the Schools, whether you're a writer in residence or a writer on staff, asking us, you know, are you writing? What are you writing? You know, we all sometimes do writing challenges together. But my writing has started to emerge, and I've started to revisit some of the things that I have been dabbling with. My friend Dan calls it dabbling because writing can feel overwhelming. So I've stopped saying that I'm a writer. Instead, I'm like, I'm a dabbler. So I did bring a couple things that I just thought I'd read. A couple poems that they're not even poems. They're things. They're things. So I thought I would read a couple things that might speak to kind of the value that I see in excavating stories about childhood and about looking at imagination as a powerful tool. I was revisiting some things and I found these and I was like, oh, these might be worth dabbling with some more. So they're completely unfinished, and that's always the best thing to share. So so with bravery and courage, speaking of courage, here we go. This one's called The Summer I Learned to Believe in Lies. The babysitter and her boyfriend are having sex in our bed, and we can't go back. All the parents are dancing outside on the deck. We can hear them laughing. It's getting darker. Locking ourselves in the basement, we decide we are magicians. My sister wraps herself in dirty sheets and waves our father's gun above her head. She makes the babysitter disappear. We build a fort with our stuffed animals, and my sister teaches me about the bad guys. They'll sprinkle gold dust on your head, and you will die in your sleep. I saw it on TV. I listen to her breathe and stay awake. Bullets slicing through the sky, rifle barrel out the bathroom window, and a fat groundhog in the garden, dead. I've never seen our father smile so wide or heard our mother scream so loud. This war is real, my sister whispers from our treehouse perch. It's time for us to become invisible. We plug our ears with leaves and army crawl across the lawn. My sister says this time we won't be coming back. 4 peanut butter sandwiches, 6 chocolate milks, my dog Clancy, and her bear named Bear. I cry when she writes the note that says, we're sick of their fighting. They shouldn't try to find us, and goodbye forever. We sit on the curb at the top of the driveway and wait for the bus. It isn't a bus stop. You need to be patient, she scolds me. So I eat all the sandwiches. And my sister tells me the story of the day I was born, how Mom and Dad tried to send me back, but she saved me with her magical coyote howl. I beg her to show me, clapping when she arches her back and shakes her matted curls. By dusk, my eyelids droop. It's time to build our shelter. I follow her long shadow to a tent that waits for us in the backyard. Someone has left a walkie-talkie, a Ziploc bag of homemade cookies. See, my sister smiles, putting her arm around me. God is always with us. So that's one. Do I have time to read a second one?
Absolutely. And I like your sister's worldview. And thank God she stopped your parents from sending you back.
Well, again, the poem is called The Summer I Learned to Believe in Lies. So I'll leave it there. And this one's called We're All Waking Together and It's Okay. When I was 7, my grandmother told me that creating is a lifelong vocation. So I slathered on some suntan lotion and found my favorite yellow striped bathing suit and asked when we were leaving. She told me I was the protector of our family's secret history, and that if I wanted to reconstruct it, I should probably move very slowly. She suggested that I use the scrap paper by her rotary phone and Monday night's rinsed tomato jars and her old beach town postcards. My grandmother has always said that magic lives in doing, not in talking. She taught me to summon all my ancestors, and I took them on safari, and I learned all of their names, and they were grateful. I showed them how to glare at zebras, have a growling contest, how to snuggle up to lions without fear. Everyone was allowed to rest their heads in mouths filled with sharp teeth, and I urged them to make friends with any beast they had learned to believe was dangerous. We rode elephants. I gave them tips on how to build bonfires in the pouring rain, showing them where all the holy people lived. At night, when the giraffes were snoring, my ancestors described what it was like to be so happy now that they were now brave. These days, I stretch my legs out in front of me like I don't believe it's possible. I run my hands along the fresh graffiti in tunnels, praying to the kids who did it to make me fast and irresponsible, too. At each stop sign, I roll down my car window and motion to the driver next to me so I can ask in my best Morgan Freeman voice if they believe in God or sex or anything at all. And when these people look at me like I'm unstable, I lean over and shove a brand new $20 bill through their passenger side and gun it down the busy street, squealing the corners and turning up the radio until I finally find my one-bedroom apartment, which keeps moving from the east side to the west side of this city without feeling any need to let me know. Yesterday, my grandmother told me over the phone to be gentle with myself. She said that we're all waking together in this life, and that it's okay to leave my messy signature on the subway floors to be grumpy and sad and unreliable, but that I should try to keep doing jigsaw puzzles and polishing my gold earrings and calling my mother and going to church on Sunday, even if it rains relentlessly. I listened to her sip her hazelnut coffee, not knowing why I continue to trust her to teach me about what matters the most. At one point, I said how I think it's amazing we've both made it this far without losing an arm or a leg or a head. She chuckled quietly and said that I must always try to remember that all of the real adventures are still waiting for us.
Oh, I like that.
Thank you.
I like that. You know, we often remind our audience when we close that it's never too late to live happily ever after, and I see much of that thought in that story. Hmm. Is your grandmother still living?
She is, and she's the artist in the family. She has these huge news boards that she creates that are out of poster board, and every year it has a different theme, and so she is the keeper of all of our family's news, quite literally. Anytime a cousin or a child or a grandchild or anybody calls her, she'll write down what they have to say, and she decorates these huge boards and laminates them and keeps them. We have literally 20 years of news under her couch.
Although I'd be very careful about what I'd say to her, I think.
Yes, we learned that
too. I shared
too.
A few things with my grandmother that I would probably prefer not go out in the family newsletter.
I was interested in the way in which in the second poem, the present and the past sort of coexist. Mm-hmm. And it's very much, I think, the way stories work for these children, mm-hmm. too, that I was talking about the sort of lack of sequence. And I was thinking as you were reading that we as poets, you know, we're probably closer to the way children think than mm-hmm. most people. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's why we love this kind of work.
Maybe Absolutely. So. One thing I enjoyed was also, I enjoyed seeing who that little child was, but then getting to see the adult that she became.
Mm-hmm.
That's really cool. I'm one of the few that actually get to sit here and watch you read it instead of just hear your voice. I think that little girl would be very happy with who you became.
Thank you.
Robin, do you have any poems that you would like to share with us?
I brought one, too. I've never done a poem on the radio before. And what I would like to try is to read it and then to talk a little bit about the stories in it.
Absolutely.
Okay, so I'll read it first. It's called The Way. The way I know, while peeling the clementines for them, that they are ripe. The way fingernails grow secretly or not at all. The way she says the word terraces and it sounds like terrorists. The way smoke travels lazily from one mouth to another, the way stories bleed as they sing, the way the cat sleeps in my spot on the bed with his head half hidden beneath his shadowy paw, the way I pray sleep will drape itself over me like a living mountain of curtain, the way I die with my father every night over and over, holding his dry and weightless hand. Now, my father died a year and a half ago, and everything I've written since then is in some way about his death or about my mother, who at the point when he died kind of checked out. She's still alive, but very, very not who she was. So in the poem, I'm trying to get at the ways in which everything happens all at once. You have this thing that, which for me was really a huge traumatic event in my life, the loss of my father. And at the same time, I'm peeling these oranges for my kids. And I'm at these parties and people are smoking cigars and, you know, all these, the terrorists and the terraces, all these things are things that happen to me within a span of 24 hours. And they all coexist. And it doesn't matter that one of them is like this huge traumatic thing that I'm not sure I can navigate. And then these other ones are the things that happen every day and that will continue to happen every day. And I thought about this a lot sort of during the storm. And as we continue our storm is not over yet here in Houston, that, you know, we're sitting there in our kitchen making 500 peanut butter sandwiches and, you know, thinking about these people who have lost their homes and we go to their house, you know, these things that are huge to us that are beginnings and endings and unchangeable facts. And at the same time, you know, my brother is texting me that his dog, you know, has set a Guinness Book of World Records, you know, for drinking water. And the same thing, we saw that in the shelter, you know, that yes, these traumatic things have happened. One of the little girls wrote, "The ocean is wearing my clothes."
Oh, wow.
And that is right. That's what she saw. Her clothes were swept away in the water. And at the same time, there's the fort. There's the time machine. There's the monkey. Stickers on Maggie's face. Stickers all over Maggie, actually. We have pictures to prove it.
We may have to put that picture on our Facebook page.
But just the ways in which the most sort of magnanimous thing and the tiniest little things happen at the same time. Hmm. And I thought a lot about that.
Mm-hmm. Wow, I like those observations. And they're so true. You know, you think of these big momentous things and you think the world stops, but the world keeps going, you know, and all the little moments that make up, you know, life, they keep going despite tragedy. A friend of mine who I won't name recently lost his father, who was quite famous. And so TV networks carried the funeral and it was a holiday in the city where he was. And what I said to him is, when you lose someone, you want the world to stop. And for me, it's always shocking when I get back on a freeway after a funeral and everyone's just going about their business. Mm-hmm. And I was saying to my friend, I said, your situation is different because the world really did stop, you know, and that's what you wanted to do. But in most tragedies, just like the kids at the shelter, no, life keeps going, you know. Peanut butter sandwiches need to be made and they need to be delivered and they need to be eaten, you know. And it's, we don't have the luxury to just sit around and feel bad about it, or to sit around with kids and say, oh, it's just terrible what happened to you. Oh, it's just terrible.
Right.
You know, we need to recognize their feelings and make sure they know that they're legitimate. But there's a lot more that goes on than just moaning about what has happened to us or what has happened to them.
Mm-hmm. And I think that poetry, it's twofold. I think that the power of naming, putting a name to an experience, having the courage and the bravery and the looking and the attentiveness to say, this is so for me, right? To put a name to it. And then, so naming, and on the other end, imagination, to envision a new world. And to you, I think that the beauty of what poetry can do is it can hold both of those things. It can be a space where a young writer, an older writer, not so young writer, can put a name to a thing and then let it breathe and become something else where it doesn't have to be literal. It doesn't, the heaviness of having to say, here's what happened in a literal way can actually, you know, result in the opposite of healing. It can result in a deep, you know, a kind of stuckness. Whereas I think poetry has the ability to move people forward in a very unexpected way by giving a space for imagination, and naming at the same time.
That's well said. I think it's extremely harmful to kids who have been, as we said, they've been through everything the adults have been through. But if their stories aren't listened to, if they're shown that they're not important, that what they've been through really doesn't matter, I worry how they're ever going to process this and what's going to happen to their emotions when big things happen in life. Mm-hmm. And they've been told, we don't have time for you to think that. You know, shut up and eat your sandwich.
One of my teachers at Iowa was Jory Graham, and she talked a lot about the secret subject, meaning that as you write your poem, the thing that you're feeling the most is going to come through no matter what. And so the idea would be that if we're, say, the three of us are each describing an orange, or peeling an orange, let's say. If say, Maggie has just fallen in love, and I have lost my father, and, you know, Greg is getting a divorce, let's say. Then each of us will describe the peeling of the orange in such a way that that secret subject, that thing, trauma is the word we've been using about it tonight, but the thing that we are most obsessed with will come through in the way that we describe that thing. And
wisdom of a writer.
Yeah.
And a teacher.
And I think that we see that with children too, that they may not be telling the story historically the way that adults will tell it, but that the things that they feel and the things that they are experiencing come out no matter what they talk about.
And that there's permission for that.
Yes,
that's the exciting
permission
part.
Is a big thing.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, I am proud to have had you two as my guests tonight, and I'm proud to even play a small role in the important work that Writers in the School is doing. And friends, if you want to find out more about Writers in the Schools, click on over to witshouston.org. And I'm also proud to work with Main Street Theater, who's also had storytellers visiting children in the various shelters. And if you want to find out more about the work Main Street does with over 130,000 Houston school children each year, please go to Main Street Theater, and that's theater with an ER.com. Thank you, Robin Riegler and Maggie Monahan, for sharing your stories, your insight, your life experiences, and these awesome kids you met. I feel like I got to meet them also. And thank you for your work with that both benefits the children of Houston through Writers in the Schools. Well, I am sad to say that our hour has once again wrapped up, but I have thoroughly enjoyed it. And Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger will be up next. They are another class program on KPFT. Please make 90.1 a part of every day. And while you're driving home, need a break from the day or a break from helping friends clear houses or clearing your own house, or if you're turning in for the night or just chilling out, join us each and every Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving a great story. Please ask children their stories, and we'll keep bringing them to you. Above all, be good to each other. Mary, Warren, Hank, Nicole, Tanya, and Floyd the Wonder Dog and I will forever be reminding you that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends.
Gather around, KPFT listeners from all over the greater Houston area. We're inviting you to a unique, one-time show of epic proportions.
Join us for the second Saturday KPFT fundraiser, where KPFT's own free minstrel show and friends present a spectacular spectacle at Station Theater, Houston's home for long-form improvised comedy.
We'll see you there from 6:30 to 8 p.m. on the second Saturday of the month. Station Theater is located at 1230 Houston Avenue. Parking is free down Dart Street and at the tire shop.
Visit stationtheater.com/KPFT for more details. You're listening to KPFT Houston.
Goes down.
You are listening to KPFT Houston.
Hello! It's that vinyl show!
I get up in the morning, kick the covers from my bed, the sunlight.